Let's talk about yourself a little bit, because I think that you put all this in some perspective. You played a very important role at just the right time. I'll tell you a personal anecdote. I was teaching a class on time and Einstein's relativity. And then I was going over these concepts of how you define the here-now point. And I was doing something which is rather mathematical and interesting geometrically, a thing called light cone. And I was putting in the center of it, I was putting the here-now point. I was saying that, well, that's where it all is. And then here's the past and here's the future. And then I went away from that a little bit and talked about nonlinear concepts of time too. At the end of the class, a student came to me and said, what is this here-now point? So I tried to answer this way. I quoted T.S. Eliot, the still point. But finally, I didn't get anywhere. Then finally, I said, look, there is a guy named Ram Dass who has written a book, Be Here Now. Read that. Maybe you'll get somewhere with it.
That's lovely.
So you started that in America. Do you see that? Do you feel that that was your role? To just do that at that time of the time of the events.
You know, it's hard to know. It's hard to, because history so much means his story. It's sort of the story that somebody projects backwards, and you can write it a dozen different ways. It felt to me like Maharaji. That was Maharaji's grace that was doing that, because. That book, Be Here Now, which really millions of people have been touched by in that kind of realm of consciousness about shifting their perspective about time, that came out of, as far as I can understand it, really one blessing out of his, one thought form out of him. When in India he said, Haridas came to me one day and he said, Maharaji, he wrote on a slate, Maharaji just sent his blessings for your book. And I said, what book? He said, whatever book you're writing. I said, I'm not writing any book. And that book turned out to be Be Here Now. And it feels to me like it was interesting. It almost served as a Bible in the 60s for a certain kind of spiritual group, a subgroup. I feel very little personal identity with it. I feel very much like I was just a middleman for something to happen in that, you know, very much less personal. I think it did play an interesting role. I think that and a lot of other books with it, I mean, it's presumptuous to think that any one book did anything, plus television and transportation and our changes in mobility and our changes, it was so overdetermined. The rock and roll movement, all of this, had the effect of changing our social, psychological domain about time and space into relative time and space in the same way that Einstein did to Newton. You know.
Yes, and it was a beautiful transformation. It was a total transformation to a new awareness.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
There.
Exactly. We saw, we had the opportunity to see a shift in human awareness on a large scale.
Yes.
And it's interesting because it's so now been incorporated into the culture, nobody even notices that it happened. It's just built in now that we all, and that's part of why morality is changing, it's part of why everything's changing. Mm-hmm. It's changing around that shift about what reality is.
That's right. We are much more here now today than we
much,
ever
much
were.
Much more, yeah.
Now this brings about a rather interesting subject of evolution. We were talking about nonlinear time. And in nonlinear time, past, present, and future all occurs together, right? Mm. So how can one define the concept of evolution? You know, when we talk about here now, in societal terms, we often get carried away and think, well, we are evolving towards a new consciousness. Mm. Yet, I find something inherently disturbing in thinking about evolution, because everything is happening always already.
Evolution is as much an illusion as anything else.
Precisely.
And it's within the illusion, it's like a greater illusion within the elusive system, the illusory system, that there is movement from a point to another point or something's happening. And within the something's happening, you can get into vaster and vaster what I call astral melodrama, which has in it evolution. And finally, at the ultimate point of evolution, you realize nothing happened. You know, and that the ultimate final point is the awakening out of the dream of Maya, or the dream of
So in that sense, evolution never really happens. Actually, I'd be a little more specific, in fact. You know, very great thinkers like Sri Aurobindo or Richard Dan, science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, they all somehow conceptualized this collective nirvana of everybody in the universe all together, melting into one part of great ultimate consciousness.
Yeah. Well, that already is somewhere. It's just that we are busy being our storyline, so we aren't fully in it. But that's who we all already are. That's the we all already are the Buddha, or the Buddha mind, or the Christ consciousness.
But that is not the end of something. I mean, there is no end. And
there's
there
no
is
end.
No
there's no end, and there's even the concept of end and beginning is a hype.
Right.
Which is at the lower levels of awareness, there are shifts in consciousness, just like we were talking about the input of relative realities into a society. Everybody's consciousness goes up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And there are those movements and progressions, and at the same place at another level, there's nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
So those are both true within that domain.
Right. And in that sense, perhaps it can be said...
There's evolution.
Yes, there is evolution.
Yeah.
And in my hypothesis is that the universe, the material universe, physical universe, and the consciousness are perhaps complementary aspects of one reality, and whereas this material universe has this one kind of cycles, like universe is created, destroyed, and so forth.
Yeah.
The consciousness,
beautiful,
is timeless and spaceless.
Yeah.
Does not have that kind of cycles, yet it has this Mayic cycles of what
exactly.
You call
and I think what the complementarity is within the Mayic cycles. See, I think we still have to get the better language to deal with consciousness, with awareness and those levels, so that we can deal with that which doesn't change as an eternal, and that which is the lower levels of those which is within the Maya, because
which do change,
yes.
Right.
And those changes are complementary to the material ones. Yes. And it's interesting, because as those changes of consciousness occur, our understanding of what science is, our ability to know, our ability to trust our intuitive knowing, all these things happen. So that you can see that as physicists and biogeneticists and all get out to the leading edge, simultaneously as this consciousness moves from, as we allow relative reality into our own awareness, we are ready for that.
Uh-huh.
And you can feel those things dovetailing just beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun for you to be in the role you're in now in society, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, it is fun most of the time. There are, of course, also times where we all get confused. And I was going to ask you about this. One of the problems that we have in Western society, because of this democratic stuff that we get very used to, you know, everybody has to have the same kind of cars or same kind of pleasure, like a television set, and so forth. That, coming from that point of view, here, one feels dejected, not quiet with it. I'm not ready for consciousness because I have to worry about my food every day.
Yeah.
And in the academia, what that means is that, well, I'm in this role of being a physicist, and therefore I have to do some grubby work with what is defined for me.
Yeah.
You know, like the physics is defined.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
For a psychologist, the psychology is defined. Now, if you stay in that role, which has of course, very nice aspects, namely that you can go for knowing the consciousness, knowing reality. Yet, there is also these aspects of getting into things which are grubby.
But I think what that is a confusion of what yoga is appropriate for somebody in a specific worldly household or role, in a worldly role. And I think that when you think of jnana yoga, of the yoga of the mind beating the mind, you think, well, if I'm doing grubby physics things, I can't be doing the mind beating the mind. But if you do karma yoga, which is taking your karma, which is doing the grubby physics things, and use those as the vehicles for awakening, then it all becomes grist for the mill. It all becomes stuff that allows you to awaken. I mean, very often a woman will come to me and she says, I have a child, and if I didn't have this little child, I could meditate. And I could get to God. And I say, well, if your child is standing in the way of you getting to God, you're not understanding how to use your karma as how to make your karma dharma, how to use what you've got to liberate you. And you can, just as Yashoda looks at Krishna, who's their little baby, and it's the little baby, and then at some point Krishna opens his mouth and she sees the entire universe in his mouth, and she freaks, you know, because this is her child, and suddenly she's holding this thing, you know, this cosmos. And at that point, it's this beautiful line in which it says, then Krishna, out of compassion, veiled her eyes once again with mother love. See, and then she was just seeing the baby again. But yet, the whole role of raising a child is a vehicle of liberation, if one uses it that way. And so, dealing with grubby physics problems.
Yes.
It's the question whether you identify with your thought process.
Yes.
If you're busy thinking you're a physicist or thinking about those grubby problems, and that's all you're doing, if you don't have that little bit of spaciousness around it that is saying, watch my attachment, see how I'm getting caught. Oh, notice that.
Yes.
See, that's the part that can use it.
Yes.